joint session of Congress tomorrow night.
The interview with Robert Mayo Hayes, conducted in Los Angeles, California, the 26th of February, 2001. And Dr. Hayes, the interviewer is Colin Burke. You were born, Mr. Hayes, 1926.
Right? That's correct.
And you told me you had a very interesting childhood and family background. Would you tell us what you thought was special about that background and how it might have shaped your career?
It's hard to say how it shaped my career, but I was fortunate to have two fathers, and I loved both of them. My mother and father divorced when I was about six, and my mother remarried. Bill Forrest, who was my stepfather, really was my father for all intents and purposes for the remainder of my life, although I did see my genetic father many times, but it was Bill that brought me up from the age six on. He became an actor in Hollywood.
Why? Oh, you told me once that the Depression really had an impact.
Well, both Bill and my father, Dudley Hayes, were in the stock market in the late 20s. They, like many others, were caught in the crash. They each knew what was going to happen, and so they were selling short. But the nature of the process was that their timing was off by a couple of weeks or whatever. And I think that was the reason my parents divorced, the economic strain of the Depression, as is very frequently the case, brought things to a head. Actually, Bill and Dudley were very similar people. Both very moral, they were tall, each about 6 feet. Bill was 6 foot two. They were both highly well educated. Bill went to Princeton, and Dudley was the president of the student body in his final year at USC, University of Southern California. He came out here from Michigan, and actually, he had been at the University of Michigan his first 2 years and then came to USC. Anyway, that was the history of my early years, anyway.
And your stepdad was an actor and traveled a lot, and you said that you went through some of 16 schools.
Oh, well, the 16 schools was, in fact, before he became an actor. He had to move around a lot to get work during the Depression years until 1937 when we came out here. So for 5 or 6 years we moved principally between New York and Detroit, because among the jobs that he took, well, there were two kinds of jobs that he took. One was as a advertising model, posing for Aero shirt ads and that kind of thing. We have at home a copy of a old Liberty magazine. I don't know whether you remember Liberty, but it was Saturday Evening Post and the like. And his photograph is on the cover. And that was the kind of thing he did. Second kind of thing that he did was auto lecturing. During those years, the auto shows were a big marketing tool for the auto industry. And so he would get up in front of an automobile and tell the audience about it, give the spiel. And so he would travel from city to city with the auto shows as they traveled, and we would be traveling with him. And I would have to enroll in a school, and I'd spend anywhere from 3 or 4 weeks to a couple of months at it. So there were some 16 schools before I graduated from high school. But we came out here, and he went in, actually went to the Pasadena Playhouse, and was in about 20 plays there, and then finally broke it into the motion picture business, became a very well-known character actor. And as I mentioned in my notes to you, if you remember the Rin Tin Tin series on television, he was Major Swanson, who was the commandant of Fort Apache, I think it was called. Very successful career until the 1970s, in fact. So from about 1940 until 1970 or 75, he was very active.
Gee. And you decided to go to UCLA just because it's close?
Money. UCLA was inexpensive. We lived 20 miles away up in Granada Hills, and I could go to UCLA essentially for free, and it was a good school, although it was nothing like it is now. I mean, today it is a world-class institution. At that time, it wasn't. It was just a good university.
What drove your interest in mathematics?
It's hard to say. As I mentioned in my notes to you, when I was in elementary school, I thought that I was going to become a lawyer because my great-grandfather had been a judge in New York City. I think the thing that stopped me from being a lawyer was I got a book out of the school library and started on law and started to read it. And at the beginning, it talked about torts. And I didn't know what tort was. I should have gone to the dictionary and looked it up. But for whatever reason, since I didn't know what a tort was, I said, to hell with it. But at that time, I was also becoming interested in mathematics. And it's hard to say why. I suppose that I was looking for structure. And mathematics embodies that. That's the nature of it.
Well, your math degrees, including your PhD, shine through your career. As far as I can tell, you're one of the first people who really start to apply mathematics in the new things, kind of what called operations analysis and systems theory, to library problems.
Well, actually, no. The person who probably was first was Robert Fairthorne.
Okay.
And that's a name that you should have in your files. He was British. Very weird guy, in fact, but mathematicians tend to be. No, he was a mathematician and very early on was interested in using mathematical techniques in library and information retrieval field.
Yeah, his name is mentioned in many of the emerging histories of information.
Yeah. Very key figure.
You served in the Navy during the war for 2 years, you said?
Actually, 1 year, 3 months, and 23 days.
And you taught mathematics for the Navy, potentially, right?
Well, actually, no. That's an interesting story. I was drafted and went down to boot camp. I'll have to back up a moment. I taught my first class at UCLA. This is a truth, as a freshman. I knew I was going to get drafted. I didn't want to volunteer. I knew I was going to get drafted, and I wanted to prepare as well as I could. So in my first semester at UCLA, I took a course in celestial navigation with the view that that would be something that would be of value. Especially because I hoped to get into the Navy, but I really had no idea. Being drafted at that time, you didn't have a choice. It just was a flip of the coin. But I figured that if I had the celestial navigation in hand, that would give me a leg up. And I was drafted, and fortunately, down at Terminal Island, where the induction took place, the Navy selected me, and so I was sent down to boot camp in San Diego, and the opportunity was still there to apply for the V-12 program. I don't know whether you recall what V-12 was, but it was the program of the Navy to train enlisted men in the Navy from the fleet to become officers. And so I applied for the V-12 program, and I can recall the interview by the board of assessment at boot camp. a couple of commanders and the captain and so on. And they really asked me only one thing. What was the first point of Aries? Which is a key thing in celestial navigation. And I gulped and I proceeded to go into my lecture. And so I think that, that turned the trick, and so I was accepted in the V-12 program and sent to University of Colorado. And spent the rest of the war at the University of Colorado, tough duty. While I was there, I took along with the Navy courses, regular college courses, among which was mathematics. And for whatever reason, the chairman of the mathematics department, who was the instructor of the class that I took, said at the end of the class, "Bob, would you like to teach?" Oh, I'm sorry, I have to back up a moment. I didn't tell the rest of the story. So I took the course in celestial navigation under Professor Samuel Herrick, who was a very renowned astronomer. And indeed, he was the person responsible for developing the equations that have since guided space travel. And so I took the celestial navigation course from Sam Herrick, and at the end of the course, he said, "Bob, would you like to teach?" And I said, "Yeah, I would." And he said, "Okay, you'll be teaching next semester." And so here I was, a freshman, in my second semester at UCLA, teaching the course on celestial navigation. Now, in the course, the students in the course were all V-12 students. they were Navy students. And so it was perfect preparation. So when I got to the University of Colorado, I took the course in mathematics, and the chairman of the math department, whose name I've forgotten, a very renowned mathematician, in fact, at the end of that class said to me, "Bob, would you like to teach?" And for some reason or another, I don't know what it was about me, but the professors would see me as a teacher. And indeed, as I said in my notes to you, teaching has been my life for since I was 16 years old, literally. And so I taught for the University of Colorado as a teaching assistant, just as I had at UCLA a year earlier as a teaching assistant at UCLA. But I was responsible for the class in each case. I wasn't serving as the usual teaching assistant, namely to work with a particular section. I had the class, and it worked beautifully.
Well, then you returned to UCLA and finished your master's, right?
I finished my BA in math, my master's in math, and my PhD in math, all at UCLA.
And you ended up in a very exciting place in that period of time.
The Institute for
the National Bureau of Standards,
yep.
And the INA at the university. How did you get there?
Well, when I got my master's degree, I was out of money, and so I needed money, and I needed a job, therefore. So since the Institute for Numerical Analysis had been established at UCLA, I went to them and said, "How about a job?" And they said, "Well, there aren't any openings here, but there is an opening in Washington. And so if you're willing to go to Washington, there'll be a job there for you." I said, "Fine." It turned out that one of the professors who had been at the Institute for Numerical Analysis, they had a variety of people come in on brief appointments, and then go. One of them was a very famous mathematician, Mark Katz, K-A-C-Z, or K-A-C. And he had had, when he was returning back to Cornell, I think, he damaged his car out in the desert, and then had to take the train or fly back. And so here I had the task of getting from Los Angeles to Washington, and they said, "Why don't you drive Mark Katz's car back?" And so I drove Mark Katz's car back for him, and that was the means by which I got to Washington. I then took the car up to New York, where it was delivered to him. But in any event, I worked in Washington, D.C. for Division 11, which was the Mathematical Tables Project, and included not only the SWAC, which was the computer at UCLA, but the SEAC, which was the Standards Eastern Automatic Computer, located in Washington, D.C. At that time, though, I didn't work on computers at all. I worked on punch card equipment. Actually, no. I worked initially as the operator of a desk calculator.
I've been there. Yeah.
And periodically, I've been asked, how does one get into the computer business? And I said, you spend 6 months running a desk calculator. Why? Because that's what I had to do. And so I ran a desk calculator. And it was dull, but interesting. And then I had responsibility for running a whole series of punch card operations. What we were doing, or what they were doing, among many other things, were running what are called Leontief matrices. The Leontief matrix is essentially an input-output matrix for economic assessment. But one of the uses of it is in projecting what the requirements over time are going to be in order to meet identified objectives. The matrix shows what the input necessary to produce output. And so given that, if you want to generate a certain output over time, you have to develop or pass the Leontief matrix on over that time period in order to take what the necessary inputs are to generate that output. And so we were just running these Leontief matrices.
A very, very practical, everyday application of emerging systems analysis and things, right?
Well, not really, but a very significant application of an economic model that has far-reaching importance, and that was my task at that time, was to run the punch cards that would do the calculations.
You ended up back in at UCLA fairly soon, right?
Yeah, and then after about 6 months or so, or maybe 9 months in Washington, they announced a program of fellowships. And again, I applied for that and was accepted. And the fellowship involving returning to UCLA as a doctoral student, paid for by the National Bureau of Standards. All my costs were paid, and I had a salary as a fellow to work at the Institute for Numerical Analysis. So the economic problems were completely now solved. It wasn't a big salary, but it was sufficient for my needs. I was living at home, so my costs were really quite minimal, but they were real.
You're about 22, 23 then, right?
Let's see. This would have been in 1949. Yeah, this would have been in 1949, and so I was 23.
Very young man. Well, when you got back to UCLA, did your dissertation, and apparently you met an awful lot of people who were going to be major figures in modern programming and information science, like possibly, is it Bauer? Walter Bauer, is that the fellow?
Yeah, Walt Bauer.
Yeah. They were at the Institute for a long time, right?
Well, there were a number of people that came through the Institute. There are a couple of personal anecdotes that I'd like to mention just for the fun of it. I was taught programming by Grace Hopper.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
Now, the teaching was literally nothing. She put on a class, and it was a one-day class in programming. And so she gave her lectures, and then she made an assignment in this one-day class. And so here I am sitting, and I'm sitting at my, and I can remember this like it was yesterday. I'm sitting at this seat, you know, with the kind of turn-up thing. And I was trying to figure out how to deal with the assignment. And she walked by me, and I can remember vividly her leaning over me and say, "Remember, a command is a number that you can operate on as a number." Bang, like that. It all came together, and I knew exactly what to do. So that was anecdote number one.
Were you programming in binary at the time?
Machine language.
Oh boy,
yes.
That's tough.
Oh yeah. We didn't have any. We did have an interpreter language, so that you could get around the necessity of binary encoding. But incidentally, the bootstrap for the SWAC was a set of toggle switches. Physical toggle switches that you had to set. You had to set the toggle switch for the, and then when the power was turned on, those toggle switches would represent the initial commands that would cause for the bootstrapping of the the operating program. So we did have interpreters, but it was machine language programming on the SWAC, and it was quite a discipline because the size of the memory was minuscule. And so you had to do everything within this very limited memory, not only the program, but the data that you were working on. So we didn't have magnetic tapes. The data input was either punch cards or punch tape. And the data output was almost non-existent. So it was really a very primitive kind of programming environment.
But you began as one of the very first people in the country to work on the new electronic digital programmable computers, which is very important to your career.
I don't know whether I was that much the pioneer. I was just simply someone doing it. The other anecdote is has nothing whatsoever to do with my career, but we had a variety of visiting faculty. We had UCLA faculty that had appointments at the Institute. We had lecture series. We had distinguished speakers come and speak. And I can remember one time a very distinguished mathematician was there and was giving a lecture. I was sitting in the very back row. A couple of seats in front of me, off to the right side, was a guy that looked my age and was wearing a kind of dirty t-shirt. And at some point in this lecture by this very distinguished mathematician, this student in dirty t-shirt gets up and in a Brooklyn taxicab driver accent, these, thems, and those kinds of things, proceeds to raise a whole series of questions, not so much in an attacking way, but in a collegial way. And I said, "Who the hell? How can this kid do this?" That kid was Richard Feynman, and it was right at the time that he was doing his Nobel Prize winning work in quantum electrodynamics.
Oh, geez.
And, you know, Richard Feynman is one of the great, great figures of history of science. And there he was.
Next to you.
Next to me.
We'll pause now because the tape's running out. about the MDS and what an exciting place it was at that
time.
Well,
I mentioned the second anecdote to illustrate the nature of the people that in one way or another came through, lectured, or participated in the work. It was, as you suggest, a very exciting place to work.
After a couple, how many years did you spend at MDS in this then? About 3-4 years?
Yeah, I, in 1952, in July, June or July, I completed my PhD. And that did it then. I left the MBS, not because I didn't like the MBS, but because I felt that I could make a better income out in industry. And I applied for a position at two companies. One was IBM. And I was indeed interviewed by Cuthbert C. Hurd himself here in Los Angeles. And then the other place I applied was Hughes Aircraft. And I think that the reason that I selected, and I received offers from both of them, and the offers were essentially identical in terms of the financial arrangements. I chose Hughes because I simply wanted to stay in Los Angeles. And if I joined IBM, the nature of IBM was that you had to move. And I've been tied to Los Angeles for essentially most of my life, and
well, you just gotten married too, right?
No, I hadn't yet gotten married. The marriage occurred shortly after that, and indeed, the fact that I got the job made it possible for me to consider proposing and getting married.
What were your jobs at Hughes? And was it the Hughes experience that started to get you into information processing?
No. The Hughes experience was, in fact, focused on programming a computer to fly an airplane. And indeed, the result was a series of flights over Los Angeles with pilots in the plane, but in which the computer actually flew the plane. And I was simply part of the team that was working on this task. The interesting problem about it is that you were dealing with what are called sample data systems, and in which you would have to process data about the current status of the aircraft, and you had to do that by sampling sensors.
Yeah.
And sample data systems are fascinating problems. They run into very serious issues of dynamics. And the kind of dynamic systems that Norbert Wiener was concerned with were very real in this kind of an environment. So that was my task, working on that.
At the same time, you were also continuing to teach?
Yes.
As an adjunct professor?
No, not an adjunct professor. I had an adjunct appointment, but it was an adjunct lecturer. Part of it was through University Extension, and part of it was through the mathematics department. And I taught courses essentially in numerical analysis. And you ask why. I think it's simply that I enjoy teaching, and this kept my hand in teaching even though I was in industry.
You moved to the National Cash Register Company, which you just purchased, one of the West Coast computer companies, in about 1954.
Yeah, Computer Research Corporation.
Right.
They had been, I think, part of a division of Northrop or some company, like one of the aerospace companies. The head of it was a man by the name of Don Ekdahl, You may know the history of CRC and Don Ekdahl. Don Ekdahl was a fascinating guy.
And by the way, his papers are now at the NCR archives.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So if you get a chance sometime, they may be opened up in a couple of years.
Uh-huh.
So it'll be fun for you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, CRC was founded by Don Ekdahl, initially, I think, as a division of Northrop, but then it went independent. They designed what was called a digital analog machine. In other words, you have analog computers, but the digital analog would digitize, that is, would represent the analog processes in a digital form. And that was CRC. They were acquired by National Cash Register, and it was about at that time that I joined them because I wanted to get into the, if you will, the business kinds of applications rather than the engineering kinds of applications. So I really went from mathematical applications, which was my work at the National Bureau of Standards, to engineering applications, which was the work at Hughes, to the business applications, which was the work at NCR.
You spent about a year there then?
About a year and a half, I would say.
Then you moved to a fascinating company that we know little about it, Magnavox.
Magnavox Research Labs.
Yeah.
Now, Magnavox is a company in Fort Wayne, Indiana. They held the patents on the loudspeaker, the magnetic loudspeaker, and were a very prestigious company in the high-quality radio and phonograph and the like. The Magnavox Research Labs was established out here. It was headed by a man named Ragnar Thorensen. Thorensen had been working with Harry Husky at the Institute for Numerical Analysis. And set up the Magnavox Research Labs to work on application of digital computers in what is what we would now call the information field. But basically it was in support of the intelligence community. The contracts were with Eastman Kodak as a subcontractor to Eastman Kodak on the development of what was called the MiniCard system, which was one of the early offshoots of a whole development related to Vannevar Bush's MEMX machine. The Rapid Selector was the first attempt to realize Vannevar Bush's ideas. The mini card was a second attempt, and the basic contract was from the CIA and the Air Force. But there are other contracts with NSA and pretty much in the intelligence community.
Did this experience with the mini card, it's also, they put their own proprietary name on it later, the Magna Card, right?
Well, the Magna Card was a very different development.
Oh.
This was purely a Magnavox Research Lab development. The idea was to have a small magnetic card that could be physically sorted and physically collated so that you could do everything that you could do with a punch card, but would be done with magnetic data and therefore be erasable. But you could also perform all the kinds of operations that you could perform with punch cards, sorting and collating. And that was, in fact, the thing that I was most focused on, the systems work on MagnaCard. Systems work in this sense, meaning, how are we going to use this device?
and therefore what should it look like? What should the specifications for it be so that the engineering designs could be consistent with the applications? And it was one of several parallel developments at the time for mass storage. Now, the one that really succeeded was the magnetic disk. Incidentally, the magnetic disk is really based upon an idea of a very key person, Jake Rabineau, who worked for the National Bureau of Standards and first conceived of the idea of an array of disks as a storage medium. And this was in the early 50s. IBM implemented it in a magnetic disk in the mid-50s. But in parallel developments at NCR, they had the idea of magnetic strips. And we had the idea of magnetic cards. And there were a variety of magnetic drums, of course, had been used for some time, but were quite slow and very limited in capacity. The objective was to develop media that would be more space efficient in terms of, that is volumetric efficient in terms of data storage.
Did you become interested in, quote, the information problem as such at this time?
Exactly. And it was for this reason. Namely, the application to the kind of problems represented in the intelligence community was a very real application. And it was that application, drawing in part on the experience with Minicard, but looking at more dynamic kinds of data than Minicard represented.
You stayed at Magnavox for quite a while, you ended up in Washington for a while, Washington, D.C.
No.
Did you just visit there to teach for a while?
Yes. Okay. But what happened was, and this is probably the reason that I'm in the field at all, my task at Magnavox was the systems task, namely how are we going to apply this? And the obvious application, based upon the intelligence community needs, was information retrieval. How do we retrieve information via computer? How do we store information so that it can be retrieved? I knew nothing about that. Some of the ideas for it, such as superimposed coding, the Zeto coding, had arisen earlier, in the early 50s, and had kind of intriguing implications for those that were technology-oriented. And so we had those kinds of techniques. And so I decided that I needed to understand what was going on. And therefore, I began to assemble all of the examples of techniques for storing and retrieving information that were endemic, or at least were being created at the time. Among them was the Uniterm system of Documentation Incorporated, Mortal Vitaldi, the Zeto system of
Calvin Moore's.
And so I had to assemble these and make sense out of them and relate them to what the computer could and ought to do in processing them. It's interesting to note that the people, for example, like those at Western Reserve University, Alan Kant and Perry, were trapped intellectually in the kind of matching algorithms that were involved in superimposition, and are represented in the rapid selector and in the mini-card system. Namely, instead of using logical processing, you look for the matching.
Matches, like a light shining through a
match. A light shining through, right. And they were trapped intellectually in the concept that that kind of process was the process. Rather than looking at the data recorded, however it might be recorded, simply as data to be processed. I, coming from the computer field, didn't have that mental block. To me, it was simply data to be processed. And so I interpreted everything that was happening in that light, rather than in the way in which the technology had kind of forced them to think.
The early light-based and mechanical technology.
Mechanical technology and the matching, by optical matching, was inherent in what so many people were doing. It was also, incidentally, inherent in what Mortimer Taibbi was doing, because, you know, the pin going through, or the light going through, was exactly, and similarly for Calvin Moore's, the superimposed coding, you've got the pins going through. So you've got this kind of a mindset that views the retrieval process as this simple kind of matching. Well, so I had to put this stuff together in a way that made sense to me. And being fundamentally a teacher, I said, wait a minute, what I'm doing is something that can be taught then. So I went to UCLA, with whom I had this long-standing relationship in teaching, and I said to University Extension, I have a course that I want to offer. It would be a two-week course. And I said to my friend there, how can I do it? He said, well, it sounds as though it would best be done as a two-week short course, and we can advertise it. And from what you say, from what I had told him, we could really get an audience for it. And so I said, okay, I'll put together a short course, 2 weeks, and let's see where it goes. And this was in 1958. I think that was the first time I offered it. And we had 60 students. And most of them came from Washington, but there were several from the aerospace industry here in Los Angeles at UCLA for 2 weeks. There was 2 solid weeks of 8 hours a day lecturing in which I presented my story. This is what information, that is computer application to information storage and retrieval, means. It was offered at UCLA 5 times, 5 years.
Jeez.
At the end of the first offering, I was asked by American University in Washington, D.C. to come and present the course there, because clearly there was an audience for it, and they said, we would like you to do it here as well. And so I presented it in Washington, D.C. at American University 3 times. The Air Force asked me to give a special course, that is a special offering of the same course, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Georgia Tech asked me to give the same course at Georgia Tech. And the University of Washington in Seattle asked me to give the same course for 3 successive years up there.
You had become a central figure, I guess, by this time.
Well, I wouldn't say a central figure, but the teaching was, if you will, my key for opening the door. And as that listing says, I gave it at UCLA 5 times, at American University 3 times, at University of Washington 3 times, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base 1 time. And each time, in the American University case, there were 200 students in the class. And I can remember one of the things that I said was, people do not use information to make decisions. Instead, they use information to support decisions they've already made. The response from the audience was palpable. You could feel it. Because half of the people in the audience were from the CIA. And, you know, I was sticking a dagger right into their heart, because we were right in the midst of exactly this kind of a process in which they were in the position of providing the information to support decisions that had already been made.
Did you by chance meet Joe Becker at this time? Joseph Becker?
Yes, it was during this time. Now, actually I met Joe because of the contract work that Magnavox had with the intelligence community. And Joe was in the intelligence community. An anecdote. One time I was in Washington as part of this contract work, and I was returning to my hotel, which was the old Wardman Park Hotel in Washington, D.C., which is just off Connecticut Avenue, north of the Calvert Street Bridge. And I am taking the bus, and I reach the Calvert Street Bridge, cross the Calvert Street Bridge going north on Connecticut. And off to the right, I see a sign that says Documentation Incorporated. And I said to myself, I didn't really know who Documentation Incorporated was. This was early on in this. So I said, I wonder what they are. So I got off the bus. I was within walking distance of the Wardman Park. Got off the bus, went in. It was about 5 o'clock in the evening. And I said, what is Documentation Incorporated? To the secretary, the receptionist. And she looked at me in shock and said, why don't you ask Dr. Talby himself? And there was more Talby. So I said, what is Documentation Incorporated? And so he invited me into his office, and we sat down, and we talked for the next 3 hours. And it turns out that we were doing very parallel kinds of things, I from the computer side and he from what he was doing. And that was the beginning of a friendship, anyway. About 6 months later, he invited me to participate in a conference that he was putting on. And the proceedings of that conference were published, and the paper I presented on the Magna Carta system was in that. At that conference, Joe Becker and his boss, Paul Burrell, came up to me. And Paul Burrell said, Bob, do you have any advice on how Joe can best learn about the computer field? And I said, yeah. UCLA, Western Data Processing Center, is developing a computer network. And this was in 1957. And I think that's where Joe can get the best background. And 3 or 4 or 5 months later, Joe was there.
You also, about this time, changed jobs and were apparently a founder of a company called Advanced Information Systems, which was allied with another kind of adventurous company.
Right. Well, let me explain what happened. A company called Electrotic was formed by a very strange man called Homer Rhodes. Homer Rhodes had made quite a bit of money in a company called Hydro Air, which held the patents on the anti-skid system for planes. In other words, a plane coming in and landing faces the problem of skidding. And the system for controlling that is a servo mechanism that would sample what's happening, sample data system again, would sample what was happening as the landing would occur and control the brakes so that to avoid the skidding. And indeed, as far as I know, all modern planes have hydro-air type of equipment in their landing system. So he made a lot of money and also established a lot of contacts in the aerospace industry. He convinced a remarkable set of businessmen, including Robert Gross, the president of Lockheed, and Justin Dart, the president of Rexall, to invest in this company called Electrata. And the objective of Electrata, indeed, was to exploit developments in the what we now call the information field. For whatever reason, they asked me to join them from Magnavox. And here was the opportunity to be in on the beginning of a company, which obviously had a lot of prestigious money behind it. And so I said yes. Magnavox was quite disappointed. They had been very good to me, and I think been of value to them. But this was an opportunity that I felt I couldn't lose. And so I said yes, and I went with Electrata. And I brought with me a couple of contracts that Magnavox had that they could not perform on without me being there. And so they were very generous and permitted these contracts to go with me. I suggested then, having joined Electrata and was called the vice president for research in Electrata, I suggested that we take the work I was responsible for and set it up as an independent company, funded by Electrata, a wholly owned subsidiary of Electrata, but still independent. And that became the Advanced Information Systems Incorporated. And from my standpoint, it was a most successful operation.
One that mainly did explain.
We did contract research. We did contract programming.
Mainly for information.
For information kinds of things. My partner, John Postley, I invited to join me at Electrata, and then he and I together created Advanced Information Systems.
At the Advanced Information Systems, you and John Postley, Postley worked on one of the first database management systems ever, and a lot of other things. And then, in 1964, apparently, you decided to become a professor almost full-time and went to UCLA.
Actually, full-time.
Yes. Right. What led to that?
Well, first of all, let's go back to the course that I taught on information storage and retrieval. I had the heretical idea, as far as the computer people were concerned, that librarians knew what they were doing in information storage and retrieval.
And I wanted to include in the course a presentation to computer people of library techniques. And so I went to Lawrence Clark Powell, the librarian at UCLA, the director of libraries, who hated technology. But I didn't know that. And I bearded the lion in his den. I said to Dr. Powell, I asked for an appointment, I met with him, I said, "Dr. Powell, I'm giving this course on information storage and retrieval, and I would like to include in it a presentation about librarians' methods and techniques. Can you advise me?" And he finally referred me to Andy Horn. He and Andy Horn were at that very moment creating the library school. Lawrence Powell became the founding dean, but Andy Horn was the associate dean and was creating the school. Larry Powell was running the library, Andy Horn was creating the school. So I went to Andy Horn and I said, "Andy, here's what I didn't even know him, but I met him. Here's what I am doing. I'm giving this course. I'm going to have the techniques of librarians presented to computer people. Can you help me?" And he said, "Sure." And so he participated. He had 1 day out of the 10 days of the course, 2 weeks of the course, and he presented library methods. But that led to a continuing friendship and relationship, which, as the school developed, they asked me increasingly to be involved. And they asked me to teach a course, and so I periodically would teach a course in the school. Now, that was all background to what happened in 1964. In 1964, a company was created called Hughes Dynamics. Now, Hughes Dynamics has had nothing to do with the Hughes Electronics, the Hughes Aircraft Company. It was a subsidiary of the Hughes Tool Company. And much earlier, the Hughes Tool Company had had to divest itself of the interest in the aircraft company because of chicanery that was going on or problems that were going on. With the and the Air Force was so dependent upon the Hughes Aircraft Company that they were in just a turmoil. Thompson Raymond Woolridge and TRW, as a successor to it, were created as a result of the turmoil that was going on in Hughes. That's a story that you ought to look closely at. The Hughes Dynamics had nothing to do with the Hughes Aircraft Company. It was a subsidiary of the Hughes Tool Company. They acquired AIS from Electrata, and we became, John Postie and I and our staff, became a part of Hughes Dynamics. Now, the reason I was happy was, here you've got Hughes, I mean, the Hughes Tool Company, all the money you can possibly want. Well, within a month, it became very evident that Hughes Dynamics was going nowhere. They were riven by internal and external politics of the Hughes Tool Company. The conflicts between the mafia-type people in Hughes and the Mormons in Hughes. And I don't know whether you know anything of the story here, but it's a fascinating bit of history. And it became very evident to both John and me that this was going nowhere. And so we said, what are we going to do? And John had developing relations with Informatics, and he then joined Informatics, and I had developed the relationships with UCLA, and really I'm an academic by orientation. Great. And so I said to Larry Powell and Andy Horn, how about it? And they said yes. And that was it. I became a professor in the school of then library service.
And was the school as much oriented to teaching computer people library stuff?
Not at all.
Sort, or
not
was it really?
It was a library-focused school, but Larry Powell and Andy Horn, although Larry Powell hated technology, he also realized that it was going to be important. And Andy Horn and Larry both supported me with the objective of bringing to the school this orientation.
The school also founded fairly soon, I guess 1965, the Institute for Library Research.
Institute for Library Research was actually founded not by the school. It was founded by the university as a university-wide institute. Now, an institute is
university in terms of the entire California system.
The entire California system. And there were two branches of the institute, one at Berkeley and one at Los Angeles. Incidentally, that's one of the defining characteristics of the institute. In the institute, you have different types of. In the university, you have different types of organized research units. You have institutes, you have centers, you have laboratories. An institute must be either multi-campus or multidisciplinary. A center can be single discipline. So this was set up as a university-wide research institute. And there was an office at Berkeley and an office at Los Angeles. Initially, it was intended that the director of the institute be at Berkeley. Now, when the institute was established, they asked me to be involved in it because I was already getting grants and contracts. And
for kind of like systems analysis of library.
For a variety of
networks and yeah, already.
Exactly. And as a matter of fact, when I joined the university, I immediately began sending out proposals. My experience at AIS had been that if I was lucky, I might get one out of five. So I put out probably half a dozen proposals, and I expected to get one or two of them in. First one I got, oh my God, I was just ecstatic. Second one I got, oh my God. When the six of them came in, I was scared. What am I going to do? But in any event, my success, and it was success, in getting grant funding led them to say, Bob, why don't you become director of the Institute of Library Research? And I did. And we had an associate director up at Berkeley, and he became that position was filled by Bill Maron. Now, Bill Maron had been at Rand Corporation. M.E. Maron, Bill Maron, M.A.R.O.N. And someone that had worked for me at AIS, Ralph Schaffner, went up to Berkeley. Ralph came to Los Angeles for a while, but I was unable to get the appointment that he really needed, whereas Bill Maron up at Berkeley was able to get the appointment up there that he needed. And so Ralph Schaffner went up there. And Ralph was a key person, very, very important.
Did you play an important role in the modernization of the California University library systems? I know at that time they were shifting toward research, therefore there's new library demands, they're getting federal money to help build.
Yeah, right. We were, I think, the Institute was created for that purpose. Now, Ralph, in fact, played a very key role and was very important.
In 1969, you and Joseph Becker formed a consulting company.
Yes, Becker and Hayes Incorporated.
Very famous, and very soon you published a book that some people regard as a foundation of information science.
Well, I doubt that. But first of all, the book that you're the first book was published in 1963. and that was Information Storage and Retrieval. And it became a classic text. There's no doubt about that. The book published in 1968 or 69 was The Handbook of Data Processing for Libraries. And that also was a very successful textbook. The Becker and Hayes, so Joel and I had developed a very close working relationship and friendship over the years. But as soon as he came out to Los Angeles, we just began working together.
He came out to work at RAND?
No. Not to work. He was never at RAND, as far as I know. He was at the Institute for He was at the Western Data Processing Center.
Okay.
And worked at the Western Data Processing Center, but in fact was working for the CIA. But he was using that place as the place to learn about and play a key role in what later became network development. And indeed, Joe was instrumental in the initiation of EDUCOM and served as a president of EDUCOM for a couple of years.
When UCLA was very, very tied to what became the ARPANET, and to do some prototype networking.
Precisely. And that was all happening at the Western Data Processing Center.
That's while Joe was there.
And Joe was right in the middle of it. He was very, very key. Now, quietly so. I mean, he was not a flamboyant figurehead, but he was very much there.
What did Becker and Hayes do as a company? Consulting work for libraries?
Well, it started out, and the thing that led me to suggest to Joe that we form a company, it started out with a consulting contract with the state of Washington on the development of the library network for the state of Washington. This was at the time that the Library Services and Construction Act was encouraging each state to create a statewide network of libraries, multi-type networks involving academic libraries, public libraries, school libraries, special libraries, in the kind of working together structure. And our contract with the Washington State Library was very successful. It led directly to creating what became the Washington Library Network. And WLN was one of the first, along with OCLC and Arlen, they were all parallel bibliographic utilities. And we played, our role was to provide means of resolving the political problems of bringing libraries together. And working with the state library, our report led to direct.
Would you like to talk about some of the political problems?
There weren't really political problems, but the task is of bringing people together. And how do you do that? How do you bring the diverse communities of academic and public libraries involved, the diverse libraries? You've got libraries that are separate institutions, community libraries or university libraries. They're separate. How do you bring them together into a network structure? And you have to resolve politics to do so. And that was our task.
By about this time, you're also becoming more and more involved with major, well, let's call them, decisions about systems in the United States in general. You're on policy boards, and I think you did a contract job for the National Commission of Library Information Science.
Yes, I... how can we rationalize the funding of National Library Network? And the view that I had was that you should not fund library networks by fees. you should fund library networks by public funding, and that these are public agencies, and therefore for efficiency they should be sharing resources, they should be communicating with each other, and they should do so in a way such that the individual libraries do not suffer in participation, but rather have their costs reimbursed. And so I had a rationale calling for federal and state funding of the costs incurred by the libraries in providing materials. And that was a report.
I've read one of your studies in the library loan systems.
That was the Silk system, and that similarly had the same objective. Namely, how do you develop a structure for communication that will incorporate the accounting on which the funding could then be based?
There was a public-private sector report out of NCLIS that I understand was very politically delicate.
Yeah, that was...
1982, was it?
No, that was in... it was published in 1982. It started in 1979... which was during the Carter administration. It was completed during the beginning of the Reagan administration. It was a very successful task force. We faced a very difficult political problem. Now, this is really a problem. Namely, the view by the private sector that the federal government was competing unfairly with private information. Now, recognize that the networks and databases had been, in fact, created as a result of federal funding. Bert Atkinson at the National Science Foundation had funded chemical abstracts.
In my several places, I know.
Right, and Index Medicus database had been funded by the National Library of Medicine, and ERIC system by the Department of Education. So you had a huge federal investment, but as the private sector was now building its momentum on that, they felt that the government was competing with. The prime example was Elsevier and Excerpta Medica that instituted lawsuits against the National Library of Medicine over Index Medicus, and continued over the years to do so, claiming that, for example, that the pricing policies were unfair because the pricing of Index Medicus did not include the costs of creating the database, whereas Excerpta Medica says we have to recover those costs. So it's unfair competition. So here was this conflict, as it was seen from the private sector, between government and the private sector. How do we resolve that? The task force came out with a set of principles that were essentially to the effect that government information should be made readily and openly available, and that the cost for doing so should be purely the costs of access and reproduction. And these were positions, both of which were totally at odds with the Reagan administration agenda. They were totally against open access to information of any kind. And in fact, at the meeting of the ARL at which I presented the report of the task force, the representative there from the Office of Management and Budget explicitly said the administration is against open access to information.
Even though what being referred to was just, say, giving a private vendor a chance to buy that data at a nominal sum, send it out while...
Precisely. The view of the task force was that that's the way the partnership should work. namely that the government information should be readily available to anyone, including the private sector companies that want to add value to it, that want to market it, that want to distribute it, and so on.
Was the Reagan administration against even giving data out at cost?
Oh, yes, yes. They were. Now, the example that they gave was that they that he gave, Ken Allen gave, was that we do not want our enemies to get information about our economy. And after that, I got up and said in response, I said, what you are doing by preventing access to this information is preventing industry in the United States from making necessary decisions about what it is going to do. So they were totally against open access to information, and that showed up in a variety of ways. They were also, however, totally against essentially free access to information. The right-wing economists' view is that the forces of the marketplace are the should be the determinant. Therefore, you should price things at what the traffic will bear. So the public sector, private sector task force was the report was accepted by the National Commission, but not approved by the National Commission. Now, within the last year, as a matter of fact, within the past month, the public sector, private sector task force report has been reissued by the National Commission on Libraries and Information Science, essentially as originally published, but with a new preface. And the new preface says the principles identified in this report continue to be valid despite all of the technological developments that have taken place. It was a very good report.
And I've read it several times.
Yeah.
You were still teaching while this was going on.
Of course.
And you were very, I think, instrumental in defining curricula for what became called information science.
I think I played a role, yes.
Was there something that you thought was essential, or some things that were essential to defining information science, say, versus library science?
I don't and did not think that these were versus. And everything that I did had the objective of bringing the two pieces together. I saw them as complementary, as mutually supportive, as mutually necessary. I felt that students in librarianship needed to know about computers and information science, not as a separate thing, but as an integral part of everything that they were doing. I see it as an integral part of cataloging. I see it as an integral part of reference. I see it as an integral part of library management. In the same, on the other side, however, I also see that information science in this field is not independent of librarianship. It is very dependent upon the institution and the institutional priorities and imperatives.
I kind of gave a pushy question to you when I asked that, and it was motivated by my experience of teaching in some information science programs. When I got into it, I found that it was really only about general familiarity with computers, some technical file management questions, and nothing about the logic of organizing information. And I think that that was pretty typical by the early 80s.
Yeah.
What happened? You know? Was it the market? Just the market wanted computer-oriented people and didn't care that much about library stuff, or what?
It's hard to say. Please recognize what I have said.
Yeah.
That to me, the library is an important institution. And that it is important for itself, it is important in society because of the imperatives that it has, preservation of the record of the past. open access to information, equity, the principles of what are embodied in the Telecommunications Act of equity and access. There are many people that see librarians as fuddy-duddies, as dead or dying, that see them as a threat because of the inertia that they are, that they have. In academic environments, they see them as a threat because of the money that they involve. Remember, in most universities, the library is second only to the faculty in the budget. The facts are that academic libraries, and indeed public libraries, are very well managed, superbly managed. They are very service and user oriented. Computing facilities traditionally have been very badly managed. They are very technology focused. They couldn't care less about the users. They couldn't care less about service. It's the technology that's important. The result is that libraries, I think, will survive. Computing facilities will become what they are, namely very distributed things. But still, there are those that see the library as a dying institution. I don't. I see it as a continually vital and important institution.
You have an incredibly long list of honors, which we can't cover because our time is just about up, but will be, of course, in the final draft written form. And a great many publications, and you were kind enough to point out the ones that you thought were the most significant, and those will also be mentioned. What have I not asked you that I should have?
I really can't think of anything.
Well, thank you so very much for the fascinating interview.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.